We're discussing the nationwide nursing shortage here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, it projects that the U.S. will need to fill nearly 176,000 registered nurse positions, RNs, on average each year through 2029. So with our aging population, the need for nurses was growing significantly even before the pandemic set in. Are you a nurse or taking coursework to go into the profession? Tell us about your experience. Have you worked in nursing for decades? How has your work changed and what keeps you inspired? Share at 800-642-1234. Gina Denick-Champion is CEO for the Wisconsin Nurses Association, representing our state's 90,000 registered nurses. She's been an RN for more than 40 years. Gina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Well, we've been hearing about the nursing shortage for years now. What is behind it? What's driving this shortage?
So this year, this time, I obviously is going to be a lot different than what we were even imagining probably a year ago prior to COVID. We have an aging nursing population. So just like the rest of us, you know, the baby boomers, we will be probably more on the receiving end of nursing care than providing the care. Mm. We do have nurses that are entering the profession, and that's very exciting and very reassuring. But I do know, and what I've been hearing is that COVID has, you know, really taken, really impacted nurses and their ability to continue to deliver care.
How difficult is it being a nurse in this pandemic? What is it like?
So what I would like to say that I don't think there is one nurse that is not feeling the impact. Oftentimes, and I think our hearts as nurses go out to those nurses that are working directly on the units that are caring for those COVID patients. We're also seeing individuals who did not and keep up with meeting with their, you know, their healthcare practitioner, their NP or their physician, and really delayed their care. So that is another whole subset of patients that are in our, you know, our acute care hospitals right now. Although they don't have COVID, they are, what we're finding is they have multiple system issues because of their chronic conditions. That is also just as, you know, I would say exhausting work. Again, these folks don't really have the family member that can be with them all the time. So we also have those expectations, as do nurses. We feel that's our responsibility to keep the family member informed and also do whatever we can to help support that patient.
Not to mention the stresses of putting on and taking off all of the PPE that goes into this and the careful putting it on to make sure that they are protected.
You know, I think that's a daily stressor. And I think, you know, way back a year ago, just getting the PPE, making sure we have enough, and then making sure that, you know, that the mask that you're wearing do fit. That's what OSHA talks about, the fit test, so that it really is sealing, providing the level of fit that it needs to. Not to mention all the other, you know, certainly the coverings that go across the rest of our body and shoes and the other sorts of respirators. That alone, but I think that somewhat become routine. But at the same time, it is always about taking, you know, them taking care of themselves, the nurses, but also not wanting to expose anybody to any other COVID or other sorts of infections that a nurse may have.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Gina Denick-Champion, who's CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. She's been an RN for more than 40 years, and we're looking at the state of the nursing shortage and what it is like to nurse amid this pandemic. Have you been impacted by the nursing shortage? Is it hard for you to schedule an appointment or a medical procedure? Are you a nurse? What have you noticed in these times? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Gina, how bad is the shortage here in Wisconsin? What do the numbers look like?
So I can tell you that, you know, Wisconsin prior to COVID, you know, the 2020 sort of data and numbers that were crunched in terms of what do we need. At that point in time, we were looking for about 3,000 more registered nurses. Although that was probably higher than that, but that's what the sort of the data was showing at the time. But I think we all saw in terms of when COVID, the surge really hit Wisconsin and our Wisconsin workplaces, that we did not have enough nurses. And it required nurses that were exposed to COVID, were homesick. Some really could not come back or came back very slowly just because of the impact of the virus on the individual nurse. Nurses needing to be in quarantine because of another family member. The hospitals and our other systems were looking at that as well. We also were seeing that nurses, as a result, needing to work additional shifts back to back. Wisconsin did everything they could to really try and bring in additional nurses into Wisconsin through the governor's executive order. Mm-hmm. But it was certainly a tough time for everyone. And I think that those nurses were probably running on adrenaline. But, you know, after a while, the adrenaline starts to leave. You can't keep up at that, you know, that level of energy. And what we're seeing now is the impact of that. The nurses are very fatigued, feeling very challenged. But the shortage itself shows what I'm thinking, what we could be experiencing in the very near future if we, you know, don't pay attention to what we need in the future.
Let's bring in Jim now in Green Bay with thoughts on nurses. Jim, hi. What would you like to add?
First, I want to thank Jean for all that she's doing and thank all nurses for all that they're doing. My wife is not practicing nursing right now, but she had been a nurse in she's an RNBSN, and she's been in various clinical settings and hospitals and family care offices. I think pre-pandemic even, nurses were becoming overly stressed. As I looked at friends of my wife especially, just by the expectation of patients and time management and time to do what they were called to do. I don't think anybody goes into nursing to make a lot of money, that's for sure. But I think the nursing situation as far as stressors was present even pre-pandemic. Mm. And as someone who's in a helping profession, I noticed that as I've interacted with people that I know who are physicians, nurses,
yeah,
and people who practice the arts of healing.
Jim, thank you so much for sharing your experience and what you think is going on in this profession. Gina, what does burnout look like and what are the stresses?
First of all, I want to say thank you, Jim, and please thank your wife for all that she's doing, even not being practicing as a nurse. Once a nurse, always a nurse. So for all I know, the neighborhood probably is using her a lot, but the pre-COVID, you are right, Jim. Nurses were feeling it at that point in time, as were physicians. And this certainly came as a blow. I think COVID was something new and really required, you know, whatever nurses could do. Nurses out of retirement came in to do what can I do to help. And, you know, we just rose to the occasions as nurses do. But the burnout is real. We hear about it on, you know, the sort of the social media pieces that I pay attention to. And they're exhausted. They are, you know, it's not just having to be in the work environment for maybe the shifts that they're working, but they're also having to come back home and take care of their family and their, you know, maybe their family, other family members. Also, I think just like everybody else, nurses are tired.
Let's pause there as we discuss nursing with Gina Denick-Champion, CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Are you a nurse? What is your work environment? Have you suffered from burnout in your profession or struggled to cover all the additional shifts? How many hours a day are you on your feet? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we take a closer look at the nursing shortage and what can be done about it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A survey by Nurse Grid published in January found a sharp rise in nurses expressing concerns about burnout and their mental health. More than 60% said they were most concerned about burnout in December compared to only 25% in April. Why did you decide to be a nurse? How do you handle the stress of the job? Do you have enough nurses to carry the patient load, or are you frequently asked to work more shifts? And what do you do? 800-642-1234. Gina Denick-Champion is CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in another call now. Tom is joining us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a nurse and a doctor in the family, and I also have several friends who are in healthcare. And one thing I wish had never happened was Act 10, because basically the nurses at UW and other sections of the healthcare industry all lost their ability to collective bargain. And I think that was really pulling the rug out from underneath our people on the front lines.
Thank you, Tom, for bringing that. Gina, what is the status of labor unions in nursing and healthcare here in Wisconsin?
I would say that, as Tom was saying, that those nurses that were previously had collective bargaining, that is no longer. There are just a very few hospital settings where they are still have a union contract with the hospital in that particular case. But and what we're seeing is, you know, nurses continue to be fatigued. What I've seen in, you know, those states where nurses are covered, you know, have a union contract, have a union that's representing them, I would say that those nurses are feeling COVID as probably the nurses here in Wisconsin. I mean, we are in an emergency situation here in the U.S. As well as Wisconsin.
Without a union contract, do you find that the work of being a lobbyist is even more pressing?
So yes, WNA, we do lobby on behalf of the nurses. We look to see what the issues are, regardless of whether they're a member of WNA or not. And we do pay attention to those things when we're looking at legislation that is being proposed. Mm-hmm. We've talked about, you know, what sort of other benefits can nurses receive as a result of COVID. But again, not sure whatever each individual hospital system is providing or giving nurses in terms of their appreciation for all that they're doing. I think the biggest piece that can happen, or what we really do need as nurses, is for individuals to just, you know, really pay attention to, you know, masking and social distancing and, you know, getting their vaccine, so that that can at least take away some of that pressure. However, as we said before, pre-COVID, the expectations of what nurses were you know, in terms of the care that they were providing. The acute care was certainly acute. Ambulatory care or clinics, day surgeries, are, you know, the care delivery has certainly changed to more of the one-day surgery, the clinic care, the movement to more of the hospital and the long-term care. So nurses are working and continue to work in a variety of settings to really avoid those costly hospitalizations.
We're talking with Gina Denick-Champion, who's CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. She's been an RN for more than 40 years. Mark is with us from Eau Claire. Mark, hi. I understand you're a nursing student.
Good morning. I am a nursing student. I have my associate degree in nursing, my two-year nursing, and my job is requiring me to get my four-year nursing degree. And it's certainly adding to the stress of the current situation.
So where are you at in the process of going from your RN to your BSN, I would assume that is?
It's an accelerated online program. So I have three or four classes that I have about a month to finish up.
Okay, and so you are not only working full-time, but you're also getting this degree as well.
Correct. And then coming home, and the kids are always home due to COVID. They're virtual.
So that, I would imagine, is remarkable stress.
Yeah, it's been a challenge, for sure.
Yeah. Gina, let us look here at the student base and bringing more students in, making sure that they are able to keep moving in their career. What is that like?
So obviously our nursing education programs and the nurses themselves, certainly the pre-licensed nurses, you know, obviously were not allowed to come into the acute care setting or a lot of settings just because of COVID. So they had to move from a, you know, in-person to online simulation, which, you know, simulation these days is amazing. And I think that the evidence shows that those nurses are getting a good education, but certainly not like the hands-on that we would all love to see them. However, they are back into clinical settings. And I think everyone is delighted that they're back into those settings. But we do need to increase the supply of our nurses. We've got, again, as baby boomers, we're seeing that of the 57,000 registered nurses currently providing direct care, more than half plan in retiring in less than 9 years. So that, you know, should create a pause.
That's very sobering. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's bring in Linda now in Eau Claire. Linda, you're UW Eau Claire's College of Nursing Dean.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and kudos to Gina, president of our Wisconsin Nursing Association. She's been doing a phenomenal job advocating for nurses, in particular during our COVID scenarios. But as she and I both know, that we cannot help, the academic settings cannot help the nurse supply in the workforce until we address the nursing faculty shortage. And right now in Wisconsin, we turn away over 500 qualified nursing students because we have a nursing faculty shortage. As Gina mentioned, within the next 5 years, we are looking at 250 of our nursing faculty retiring. And it goes up to 58% of all across Wisconsin, two-year programs, four-year programs, graduate programs, LPN programs. We're seeing a huge exit, and I am finding it's been accelerated because of COVID. Not only is there burnout in the practicing nurses, but there is intense burnout with faculty as well. So I celebrate Mark, who's on the call, continuing his education, but it's challenging. We need to be able to fund students to get through quickly so they can get to the workforce and help
get to
out.
The floor. Linda, thank you so much. Gina, final last words there on the faculty shortage.
It's real and it's scary. We're concerned. We're actually doing a Nurses Day of Action tomorrow to really bring legislators' attention to how we need to grow our nurse faculty. So that's on the faculty side of it. And I know we're running out of time, but if I could, I know as we get back to burnout, is I really encourage all nurses to start taking care of themselves. It's hard to want to, you know, get up and do a little exercise or to eat something healthier, to get some mindfulness in. But really, once you start, and it can become a habit for you, and it is what you need to
right now.
Really
yeah. Get through. Gina, thank you for joining us. Gina Denick-Champion, CEO of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rose Lavelle rocketed to international fame in 2019 as a new star on the U.S. women's soccer team.
Rose up the middle. Looking, cutting, shooting, go! Lavelle, 2-0 the U.S.
She scored in the team's World Cup final victory and left with the tournament's Bronze Ball Award. The former UW-Madison standout is now training for the Tokyo Summer Olympics, splitting her time between the national team and an English club. WPR host Keely Boltina caught up with Rose.
The women's national team is training for the Olympic Games in Tokyo this summer. So how was it for you when those games were postponed last year because of the pandemic?
Yeah, obviously, I think we were all disappointed, but first and foremost, like, everyone's health and safety is the most important thing. So it was, like, completely understandable. And I think kind of by the time it got canceled, there was, like, I feel like by then we kind of expected it. So it's not like it came out of the blue. I feel like we had some time to kind of digest what was going on. And we got grateful to hopefully have the opportunity to play there this summer if it happens. But yeah, we'll see.
How much has the pandemic affected your training for the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody was kind of put on hold for a little bit, everybody's training. And I think we're all kind of trying to get used to this like new normal, but I think everybody's going through it. So it's not like this is like something that's unique to our team. It's like the whole world is going through this. So I think, yeah, we just have to kind of like adapt and adjust and go from there.
So much of sports is that there's this community, right? And we've seen so many stadiums just empty for good reason. But how much does playing without fans affect your game?
I wouldn't say it like affects like our game. I think obviously when there's a crowd and fans, it makes the game that much more fun because the atmosphere is so much fun to be a part of. I don't think it changes the way we play, but they're definitely missed. We love the energy that the fans bring, and they do help like give us some momentum during the game. But yeah, like I said, obviously health and safety is like the most important thing. So something that I don't think we'll ever take for granted again, and we're excited for whenever we can fill up the stadiums again.
Speaking of fun, in January, a Madison, Wisconsin soccer club announced that a cow mascot would be named Rose Cowbell in your honor, three letters off from Rose Lavelle. How do you react to that news?
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's so funny. I just think it's like so on brand for a Wisconsin sports team. And I was honored. It made me so happy. It's so cute and proudest accomplishment. I don't know if it's an accomplishment for me, but biggest honor, I should say.
Of all the things you've done, Rose Cowbell ranks up there.
Oh, yeah.
You recently moved to England to play for a club in Manchester City. How's that experience been different than your time with American clubs?
Yeah, it's been awesome. I think Manchester's been pretty locked down, so we haven't really been able to explore the city, but it's okay because I get to go and train and then come back and kind of have the rest of the day to just drink coffee and be by yourself and read a book. So that part's honestly not been too bad for me. I think the playing is great. The team is awesome. And I just wanted something that was going to kind of push me out of my comfort zone. And it's doing just that. I feel like I'm really growing both on and off the field. And it's been a great experience.
How do you assess the level of competition you're dealing with there versus your other experiences?
It's good. I mean, it's a league that is continuing to grow and get better and attract really good players. And I think it's an exciting time for women's soccer because I think we're seeing so many different competitive leagues pop up. There's not one single destination league that all the players need to go to get good competition. I think globally you're seeing competitive leagues all over the place that players can play and get good games and compete against really good teams.
Rose Lavelle plays club soccer for Manchester City in England. She's a midfielder for the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, and in college she played at UW-Madison. You're listening to this conversation on the Ideas Network. Rose, in December you spoke to UW-Madison students about executing under pressure and working through adversity. Do you feel like there's more pressure on you after winning the 2019 World Cup?
I mean, I think when you're on this team, the expectation is always high and there's always that pressure. But I think this team has always kind of thrived under those circumstances. And I think I've been lucky to be on this team with some amazing veteran players that I have gotten to learn from and see how they kind of handle and navigate all of it. So I think it's something that I'm continuing to learn to kind of deal with and compete with. And I think it's great. I think pressure is a privilege. And when you're put in a position that you have these pressure and expectations, it kind of makes it even more fun.
A privilege and more fun, but fame can also be really crushing for some people. After the World Cup, how have you dealt with the fact that a lot more people know who you are?
I don't know. I mean, I think after the World Cup, I always say this, I would have thought that after I kind of accomplished this huge goal that I think we had all set out for, that I would feel some kind of different, but I literally feel the exact same. So I don't really know if it affected me in that way, because I don't really feel any different personally. I feel like I'm just kind of going about my life the same way I always have, just now with a little more experience under my belt.
Athletes can be influential among fans, and public health authorities hope that they might be able to play a role in the pandemic by publicly endorsing vaccinations. Do you plan to get vaccinated?
Whenever it's available, I will gladly get vaccinated. I don't really know when the timeline is that'll be available to me, but when it is, I will. Yeah.
Because athletes play such a public role in our lives. I mean, we also saw that with social justice. From your perspective, what responsibility do athletes have to be leaders in their communities or advocates for change?
I mean, I think we do have a huge responsibility, because I think there's a lot of younger people that look up to us and want to be in our shoes one day. And I know I was that when I was younger. I looked up to all these professional athletes and the U.S. Women's National Team specifically. And it's been something that I've been really proud to be a part of. I think our team has always made some bold statements against injustices, and I feel so proud and honored to be able to be a part of that and hopefully help influence the younger generation in a positive way to spark change and have them know that they are capable of doing it too.
We saw that really specifically after the killing of George Floyd last year in Minneapolis. I mean, the whole country saw athletes across sports speak out against police brutality, and they called for change. How have you seen change since then in American soccer?
I mean, I think like the biggest thing right now is kind of having those those tough conversations within your team and trying to kind of get people on the same page that this is something that needs to change. It's not good enough. It's never been good enough. And although it may be better than what it's been in the past, better doesn't mean good. It can still be bad and better. I think half of it's kind of just having those conversations with your teammates, and it's not always going to be comfortable. But I think if people can kind of open their eyes and realize, like, we need to make this country a better place for everybody, then I think that's the direction we need to go. And hopefully the conversations can help. And then kind of doing some work behind the scenes to help, like, give more opportunity to everybody.
The conversation about social justice, it makes me think of the issue of equal pay. I mean, the women's national team has been seeking better working conditions and equal pay from the U.S. Soccer Federation. And in December, the sides announced an agreement on working conditions, but not on equal pay. What do you want people to know about this?
I think, like I said, we are a team that's always going to push to make things better. And we want to leave this team in a better place than for the players and girls that are coming up. And we're gonna keep pushing to do that and push for equality and push for what we know we deserve.
Why is that so critical for you?
I think because girls need to grow up and know that this is a viable option for a career, and that it's not just a man's world, that they are very capable of becoming a professional athlete and making this a career, and realize that this is like very much a realistic future for them, and that nothing can hold them back. Hopefully we can inspire people to keep pushing and that we're like on the right track.
What do you want to tell young soccer players, especially young girls who want to pursue this professionally?
I mean, I think of when I was younger, I always think I had this vision of myself of being on the national team. And I think, I would just say to younger girls, younger kids, to never doubt for one second that you could be in our shoes one day. I think the confidence that you have in yourself is going to far outweigh anybody else's opinion of you. So if you have your sights set on something, don't let anybody get in the way of that.
Did you always know that that would be your path?
I had always envisioned that this would be my path. I think I always think it's like a little weird how it actually did work out. But being on this team has always been my, like, where I saw my future. I looked up to the team so much and wanted to be in their shoes one day.
And now you are.
Yeah.
Rose, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was UW-Madison alumna Rose Lavelle from the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. Coming up, we look at issues at the intersection of the UW system and our state's technical colleges. Should tech colleges be able to develop general ed programs without a green light from the UW system? Is there consolidation in the works between UW branch campuses and tech colleges? 800-642-1234. We have a WPR reporter brings us up to speed in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Technical College System wants to change a longstanding state law to allow their campuses to develop general education programs without approval from the UW system. And there have been some talks of consolidating the UW system's branch campuses with tech colleges. We'll take the issues in higher ed one at a time with your questions, 800-642-1234. Rich Kramer is following developments. He's a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at the rumblings around consolidation. Why did interim UW system president Tommy Thompson suggest this idea of consolidating two-year campuses with the nearby tech colleges?
That is a question that I wish I could answer. All I know is that based on the reporting of of Kelly Meyerhofer, who's the higher education reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. This isn't a discussion that just came up. You know, it wasn't something that Tommy Thompson brought out of thin air. Supposedly, former UW system president Ray Cross had also considered it as part of a list of things he wanted to do, or a list of proposals he wanted to put out there on his way out. So it was a discussion at the high level, but Tommy Thompson brought it right into the public because there was this Wisconsin Policy Forum panel discussion. It was him, Chancellor Rebecca Blank, and then Chancellor Mark Mone of UW-Milwaukee. And he just said it out loud. And I remember hearing that, and I just kind of thought, well, that's interesting, but I didn't know if there was anything to it. But then this other reporting showed that this had been discussed. From what I've heard from the people that I talked to in various schools and whatnot, they don't think there's a lot of meat on the bones at this point.
Okay.
That it's just kind of an idea. Also, there's the reality that technical colleges function as a local unit of government. They've got their own boards. They can, you know, set tax, property tax levies, and the two-year campuses, the two-year UW campuses, just can't do that. They've got the buildings are owned by the counties that they are in, but it's a complex ownership model between
the ownership local arrangement. Yeah.
Yeah. So how it would work is unknown.
Well, how did technical college leaders respond to this idea?
Essentially, so I talked with Wisconsin Technical College System President Morna Foy for the reporting that I did on their request and their budget to get the associate's degrees. And I asked her about the potential consolidation of these two-year branch campuses. And she said that they're not interested in having the UW take over responsibility of any technical colleges. She didn't say much on the other way around, like the idea that maybe the technical college system or local technical colleges could take over some of the responsibility of running these two-year UW campuses. But I just got the sense from her and others that I talked to that this was just kind of an idea that was thrown out there, but
yeah. I mean, we've talked on our program with President Morna Foy a number of times, but we've never really delved into what the relationship looks like between Wisconsin's technical college system and the UW system. Do you know any of their inner workings, their relationship with each other?
Well, aside, you know, I did this story about this really interesting 1973 law. It was actually part of a state budget that requires, technically, it requires the Technical College System Board and the UW Board of Regents to approve any new degree programs, you know, any new associate's degree programs at the technical college level. But also it requires both boards to approve any kind of like worker training programs that the UW wants. And the Technical College System Board does, in fact, they have in the past, as I think the last one was 2007, they did go through the process of getting board regents approval on some expanded degree options at like these are general education degrees, associate's degrees at the Chippewa Valley Technical College, which is in Eau Claire. But I just don't know of any examples of where the UW system went to the Technical College Board to ask them for permission to do much of anything. And that was also echoed by state assemblyman Dave Murphy, who's kind of the head of higher education in terms of the legislature.
Well, you know, tech colleges are known to be so very nimble in bringing new programs, you know, online and not online, but just offered.
Right.
You know, would getting rid of this law actually make the, you know, decrease the amount of red tape in order to bring new programs, you know, to students?
I mean, on its face, it seems like it would. And also, you know, President Foy of the technical college system said that this creates a huge step for them, because they've got their own procedures for. She said that whenever they want to do any kind of new program, not general education 2-year degrees, but like worker training certificates or something, they are able to pivot based on the need of the students, what they want, and also what businesses in the area around the technical college want. And you're right, they are able to move pretty quickly. But they, you know, Morna Foy said that it's still a very rigorous process. They go through approvals at the state level board and the local boards, et cetera. But then under this law, what they need to do is go to the regional UW system chancellors to get them to sponsor or sign on to a pitch for a new associates of arts or associates of science degree. Then they got to get that on those chancellors work to get that on the agenda for the Board of Regents. And then they have a vote. And, President Foy said that's just, it's unnecessary because the two systems have evolved over the years to a point where it doesn't really make sense.
Rich Kramer is with us, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's bringing us the latest on the working relationship between the UW system and the state's technical college system. Let's bring in a call now. Cindy is with us from Appleton. Hi, Cindy. Go ahead.
Hello. Well, I know Tommy Thompson's been talking about combining these systems together and eliminating some of the technical colleges, which I think is very discriminatory, because in a community where people live, if they can go to technical school, they can ride a bus, they can ride a bike, or they can walk. Now, if you have students who are in Appleton that now have to go to Oshkosh or Green Bay for a technical school, how are they going to get there?
Yeah, so Cindy bringing up the issue of transportation and ensuring these campuses are in the communities that serve the students in that community, Rich.
Yeah, you know, the issue of access is a big, big part of this discussion. You know, the 2-year UW system campuses have been suffering in terms of enrollment. Some of them have seen enrollment go down by 30% a year. And that's really pretty rough if the majority of the funding that you get is from tuition. So that's kind of why we haven't really heard any lawmakers outright say, well, let's close some of these 2-year campuses, because that would create a huge issue for access. Likewise, the technical college systems, and for the record, I don't think that anytime soon, I don't think the UW is going to be taking over any technical colleges or vice versa. This discussion might continue. Maybe there will be more collaboration between the 2-year colleges at the UW and the technical colleges, but I just don't see anyone taking over each other's outfit. But also, because that's a major issue. If one of these things closed, it's just the most of the people that go to these 2-year campuses are local. They're regional. They're people that are what you don't consider a typical college age student. These are people that are working during the day and have to take classes at night or something like that. So access is a big, big issue.
Rich, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. And for disclosure, WPR is a service of UW-Madison. Just ahead, a former Navy SEAL and founder of the group Veterans for Responsible Leadership talks about fighting Trumpism and promoting U.S. military values amid the pull of extremism following the Capitol insurrection. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.